myself that took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
But these fellas will get such a f***ing shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their f***ing asses for f***ing 10 years.
So the GEA Joe account, Connor, tweeted out last week about the best minor you've ever seen. And I was interested in seeing some of the replies back to that, because I replied to it myself about our very own Beano McDonald. So Beano won three Leinster minors in a row. He played minor for three years. He won three Leinsters. He played in three All-Ireland minor finals. He won two of them and they were beaten in the final by Tyrone, a brilliant Tyrone team, in his third year. So I was kind of thinking that can't really be beaten. Beano is the greatest minor that has ever played the game. But as it turns out, there were better minors probably than Beano McDonald. Like David Clifford obviously is one that jumps out to most people. Like Michael Deignan replied back and he said John Troy. He was obviously Offaly centre forward that most people remember him. He was on the Offaly minor panel for 4 years, 86, 87, 88, 89. He won three Leinsters and three All-Irelands along the way. And he won all of them in goals. So yeah. that was an interesting one. Michael Deignan. Like there's other, like obviously Joe Canning, kind of big ones. One minor really jumps out at me that I always remember thinking, geez, he's a brilliant player. And he didn't really make it was Declan McCrossan from Tyrone. Like he had a moustache as a minor and he always kind of stood up. But he's this real swashbuckling centre back. He looked like he was maybe about 25 playing minor. You know, he was kind of a standout one. I'm trying to, like, who's a big one in Mayo? Surely Kieran McDonald was one of the greatest minors that has ever graced a field in Mayo.
I don't think Kieran McDonald really came to prime. Like, he obviously was an underage star, but not the way that, not in the same tones that you're talking about Beano or David Clifford, to be honest. Like, the obvious one, and it's a really obvious one for me, was Aidan O'Shea. Because Aidan O'Shea, I think, on the Mayo team that got to an All-Ireland final in 2008 against Tyrone. And I suppose he was a brilliant player, obviously, but what made him stand out at minor more so than anything else was his size. Just really looked like he was a man beast. He was like just a man against boy, a man about boys, basically.
Yeah.
But he actually back then as well, he was probably more of a scorer than he is. Definitely a point. He used to play centre forward. He's more even a traditional centre forward than the centre forward he became as a senior. But he was really fully formed. He as a minor player, and then he ended up making his debut as a senior player the year after he played minor. So that's from Mayo, that's the one. But like the way I kind of judge kind of outstanding minors would be you hear this hype about them that like, oh, these guys are going to be absolute superstars. And now for me, you've mentioned them already, Clifford and Joe Canning. From when these lads were 16 or 17, they were being talked about as the next best thing. And fair play to Clifford and Canning, they've lived up for it as well. Just Clifford particularly, that year that Kerry won the minor when he scored 4-4 against Derry, Mayo got to the All-Ireland final that year. So Clifford played in a couple of games before the Mayo senior games.
Right.
And he was the type of guy that like, you know, you'd make sure you'd leave the pub in time to catch the minor game. And that was no small deal, I can tell you at the time, Pulley. But by God, has he lived up to the hype since?
Yeah, no, he definitely has. Joe Canning, they're the two big ones where you kind of hear whispers about this fella, even when they're 16 and they kind of filter throughout the country. Remember Eugene Clunan and Eugene O'Neill? I just remember them specifically because they're in the minor All-Ireland hurling final in 96. The year I was minor, and there was huge talk about them. They were both number 14. It was like the two Eugenes going head to head. Didn't have unbelievable senior careers, the two of them, funnily enough. But anyways, the winner of the greatest minor that has ever played the game, it was Gerard O'Kane, obviously Glenullen and Derry footballer, who replied back to me about this, about Dermot McNichol. And it's an interesting one because we did the 1993 All-Ireland final nostalgia show, myself and Conan. And I remember Conan saying to me, I didn't remember Dermot McNichol really playing at all too much. And I remember that final, he came on at half time. And I remember Conan saying, and that was a big controversy in itself because the great Dermot McNichol. And, you know, I just didn't really know much to talk about it. But anyways, I got looking about Dermot McNichol. So before Dermot McNichol left school, he'd won three minor Ulster titles and he'd played in three All-Ireland minor finals. Winning one as captain and playing in his first at the age of 14. He played 4 years minor. He played in five McCrory Cup finals, winning four of them. The first McCrory Cup final he played, he was only 14, and that's a record. But we're not finished yet. He was still in school when he won a senior All-Star for Derry, and he's the youngest ever All-Star in the GAA, and he was still in school when he represented Ireland in the compromise rules. And Dermot joins us on the line now. Dermot, how's it going?
Great, Colm. How are you? I'm looking forward to having a chat with you.
Yeah, Jesus, that's some list of achievements by the time you're still, 17, 18?
Yeah, 18 I would have been at that stage, you know. Looking back on it, Colm, it's a heavy list of games and championships and finals and that I played in, you know. But I really, really enjoyed every second of it, you know. I was brought up in my own club here, Glenall. We were football mad, and the guy that started me off in my football career was a guy called Danny McIlvar. God rest him, he's dead now. But Danny was he was way ahead of his time with regards to coaching and taking players for football and that, you know. And he had us in a wee hall down in the Fly Road, we call it, you know. And we used to train there over the Christmas time, and it was all like circuits. I mean, Danny was so way ahead of everybody else at that stage. I mean, there was no the circuits came in for me, you know, later on at county level and club level.
Yeah.
At an age of 14, we were doing circuits, and we were doing inside a hall shuttle runs, and it was amazing. But he gave me that first taste of playing football, and you know, Jerry McElhenney, my God, I used to idolise him, and he was a Derry man at the time. He was really one of the stars, and we all looked up to him, you know, at that time.
Yeah, well, like, I mean, when you're 14 and you're on the, you know, the McCrory Cup team, and you're 14 and you're playing in an All-Ireland minor final, where were you playing on the team? Or, like, were you really advanced physically, or was it this training that this fellow was doing with you?
That's a difficult question, Colm. I suppose I was fairly strong at a very early age, you know. I wasn't overly tall, but a lot of my training would have been individual training. There's a hill down below where I live here now, and I used to do serious sprints up them hills, and I think that maybe helped develop me power and my legs and that, you know. And
yeah.
I also remember at a very early age around the Glenall here, myself and a neighbour here, Henry Martin Hassan, and boys like that, we used to just be on our bikes the whole time, and it was never, we were always out doing something in the fresh air, and whether it was cycling, whether it was running, you know, even going to training, like we would have walked to training and at an earlier stage, and you know, you would have done anything to get yourself involved and the team, you know. And the boys that I played with at that age, you know, were, you know, mad about it as well. It was just built, we were just brought up with it, you know. And Danny McIlvar has to take serious credit for that,
right?
You know, he lit that fuse that got us all and mad about football, you know.
Well, there must have been fierce excitement about you in Derry around that time, because we kind of had it with Beano McDonald here in Laois, and we see it recently with David Clifford. And I suppose what they did in the game wouldn't be even, you know, it wouldn't be on the level of what you were doing back in the early 80s. Like, I mean, was everyone in Derry talking about you?
Not really. Well, you didn't have the same social media. You didn't have the same comments that you have. Players, you know, are now, you know, you have all them Instagram, you have Facebook, you have, you know, all them different social networks and that.
Yeah.
We didn't have that at the time, but you still did have the local papers, you still had the national papers. I remember the time that I was representing Ireland and the compromise rules, that, you know, the TV cameras come into the school for the first time, you know. And yeah, it was pretty big at that time. But as I say, I just didn't see it that way. I just took it that, look, this is what it is. You know, I'm playing for different teams, and I'm just enjoying it. And I didn't realize it was as big as it is now. Looking back now, like, it was a serious achievements, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky that so many of the managers that were in charge of me, you know, they give that trust on me, and you know, they believed in my ability that I could play the game, you know. So I was very, very lucky that way.
So I believe that you were a very good rugby player at the time as well. So you're playing with Glenullan, you're playing McCrory Cup, you're playing, I presume, under 14, 16 and minor at football. How many teams were you playing with at that time?
At that time, Colm, I was playing, starting off in the club, under 14s and under 16s and minors and seniors as well. I was playing for Glenall seniors when I was 14.
Jesus.
Yeah. And then, well, we're a rural area, small enough population, like, but it's a serious, we produced some brilliant, brilliant footballers down through the years, you know, really, really good footballers. And Paddy Bradley's from my club. And, you know, Gabriel Bradley, Liam Bradley, there was Declan McNichol, Jahal McNichol, Raymond Rocky Conway was, Michael Murhurtig in the minor final in 83 said he was the best minor he's seen coming into Croke Park. You know, these are the type of quality players we had, you know, at our disposal at that time, you know. And, no, we all played, you know, a lot of those boys would have been playing you know, under 14s, under 16s and minors. Not too many were playing seniors, but yeah, it was serious times. Then you looked at the school. I moved into the school. You know, at that time I was playing for the Corn and Oak, which is under 15 and a half. I was playing for the Ranafast, which was under 16 and a half. And then I was playing for the McCrory as well. So there was quite a bit on my plate. But hey, I loved every second of a column, you know.
Yeah.
And as I say, you know, you make so many friends out of it, and you know, it's to me, it was just one of those things that came natural to me, and I loved it, you know.
Yeah. And so just by the time you're 21, then you've added two more Ulster under 21 titles, two Sigerson Cups, and you were 19 when you captained Glenullan to their first county title in 57 years. And I was wondering how you were captain at 19, but I suppose if you were with them since you were 14, that kind of maybe explains it.
Well, again, you know, it was, we had our column. You know, you're so lucky. I was looking there. I think you've watched six or seven county titles, haven't you? With
Six, yeah.
And then you have an Ulster, or you have a Leinster title, and Ballina beat you in the final, isn't that right?
It is, yeah, yeah.
Well, hey, I'm sure whenever you look back in your career as well, the way I have, you know, the club is the most important, you know, it is the most important organization in your life at that time. And we had a serious, serious group of players and at that particular time that were coming through, you know. So I don't know, like, we lost a lot of players through immigration and that, you know. And we at one stage, now I'm just saying here how that club of ours was operating at the time. And you say the captain of the team in 85. I was captain in 85, yeah, but you had serious senior players. I remember one night at training, this is God, and one of the senior players, I'll not give his name now, but there was a bit of messing about going on in the training with a young boy. And this senior player went up. It made such a difference to us and our outlook. And it actually helped us. You know, we were serious for winning a championship that year. But he grabbed that young player. And he shook him and he said, "Will I tell you something? I'm such and such an age. I'm trying to win a senior championship medal. I and that means something to me. And if you're going to mess about, go and mess about somewhere else." And hey, that's the mentality and the group of players we had in 85. So even me being captain at a very young age, we had so many leaders on the pitch, so many passionate players. And we had won championship prior to that, and to win that, that was our second championship, and I knew it was on. Well, third one, we got one took off us from the county board. We actually won the game, but they took it off us. I'll just get that one in. So we did win a championship, which was taken off us at the county board meeting. But anyway, that's what we were working with. So me being captain I never thought about it. I just was part of a team that wanted to win another championship. And hey, that team, Colm, that's what I was about to say. We had on at that particular time, but through minors, through under-21s, through senior players, right, we had about 17 or 18 players who were representing Derry at some level, you know, around that period of time. And that's some. That team there, we won the championship in 85, Colm. The following year, we lost about 7 or 8 of that team to emigration. No fault of their own. Look, they had to go and find employment. But the people asked me, one of the biggest regrets of my life was the breakup of that team, because we could have dominated senior football in Derry for about 6 or 7 years. We had such a group of players, and we could have won an Ulster and whatever. But you know, that's the mentality we had at that time. We just lost players.
Yeah, you lost 7 to emigration, and like you said, during the '80s, people were leaving, you know, to find work and things like that. You stayed around until 87, won an Ulster with Armagh in 87, and then the AFL came knocking on your door. You'd been shooting the lights out for the compromise rules for 3 or 4 years, and I think they had been sniffing around you for a few years before that.
That's right. They came. They approached me and. That would have been around 84, whenever the very first compromise rules series started down in Cork. That was the first test match, and everybody talks about that one yet. It was an absolutely brutal physical, it was thuggery. That's what it was. The Australians just came out to put their marker down, and they were doing things in that test match that they wouldn't even dream about doing in their own code of football, you know?
Yeah.
But as I say, that after those group of test matches, I was approached by the Hawthorn Club, and then that went on. I went out then to Australia. Would have been 86, was it? I think it was 86. And then I was approached again, another approach, and then I wasn't interested. I wasn't I just was enjoying the football I was doing, and then. 87 came, we won the senior championship and the All-Ireland. We lost that semi-final to Meath, which was very, very disappointing. And then they came again, and that's whenever I made a decision to hell with it. They've come 3 times here. Maybe I should give it a go. And that's what I did, Colm, you know.
Yeah, because it doesn't seem like as big a decision now, because loads of fellas have gone out, but only 2 had gone out before you at that time. So it was a huge step, especially leaving Glenullen and leaving Armagh with such a great, brilliant, you know, group of players on both.
That's right. It wasn't a decision that I just made overnight. You know, I've had 3 or 4 years to think about it because of the, you know, the nature of the invitations to come out. But I looked at Jim Steins, and I looked at Sean White as well, and they were doing really well. Paul Early had been out as well, I think, at that particular time. You know, and. Whenever I went out to Australia, you know, I got to meet Sean White and I got to meet Jim, and such tragedy there. It was, you know, for the 2 lads with cancer and that. But they were so good. They were so good to me, Colin, whenever I was out there. Like Jim Steins and Sean White in particular helped me settle in and would have been out, kicking with me and encouraging me and things like that, you know. So now I have a lot of time and respect for those 2 men, and I was absolutely devastated, you know, with how it finished off.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. Was it lonely out there? You were in St Kilda. I know the 2 lads used to help you out, you know, and come across. I was reading that you used to sneak off to play a bit of local GEA in your spare time.
Oh, yeah. We would have gone down. We travelled maybe about 140 kilometres out of Melbourne to the place that we played the Gaelic games. And we would have had games, and they wouldn't have known about it, you know. And I remember Anthony, big Anthony Toole there. He got a bad injury at the time.
He broke his leg, didn't he?
He broke his leg, and that went down really, really badly, you know. That was bad at the time. But, you know, Anthony was just taken off at that stage, and he was just unlucky to get that break.
Dermot, that leg break was in a game of GEA that you were playing, was it?
That's right. Oh, yeah. He broke his leg playing GAA. So you can imagine how the Melbourne Demons at that time were taking at them. You know, they had invested here in an Irish player, and then the next thing he's out playing Gaelic football, and, you know, what happened, you know. But, I'm just looking there. They seem to be, they were happy enough there with the two players that came home there. Mark Keane was able to, Mark was able to play for Cork. And,
Colin O'Riordan, yeah, he played too.
Yeah, he played as well. So there must be a wee bit more relaxed. I think they understand, the Australians are now understanding that the Irish fellas, you know, they need to, that wee outlet because of the, you know, the homesickness and being away from their communities and that, and their friends. So I think they're appreciating the fact that they need that wee outlet to whenever they go back or whenever they're out there, you know.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, when you played with in the kind of, I don't know, the second team with St. Kilda first, and then you graduated to the first team, and you had some terrible luck just before your first game. You tore your groin. It wasn't game 11 before you had your first game. And then you did you break your collarbone and you broke your wrist? Is that the start of your injuries that year?
That was unbelievable, Colm. You talk about really, really bad luck. My first year I played with Paran in the VFA and was going great guns there, and then St Kilda, they were it was like a feeder type of club. You see, out there at that stage you had what you call districts, and that district would have been the zone area for players to play for certain clubs. So Paran and St Kilda and, you know, Sandringham areas would have been where St Kilda players, and Ballarat would have been where St Kilda players would have been drafted from. So I was in that area there. So then St Kilda took me on after the first year with Paran. And, no, things were odd. It was really, really, I was loving every second. I remember the pre-season we did was horrendous. We went to a place called Becker's Marsh. Outside Melbourne as well. It was an old Lion Park, but we went down there for a pre-season training, and it was hell on earth. I tell the students in that at school, you know, whenever we were doing, you know, pretty hard training sessions for McCrory or for Brock or for Ranafort, hey boys, look, you don't even know what training is, because it was serious at that time. It was madness, Colm, in fairness.
Yeah.
And you know, we were bloody well camped in for 3 days, and you had you get up in the morning and you had a run out and get washed in an old dirty river lake type of thing. Then you had 10-kilometer runs carrying logs. You had all these different exercises. You had football playing box with a boxing glove on inside the hall. It was madness, but it was just testing the character.
Right,
that's all they were testing your character to see if you would. If you would quit, you know. But as I say, those were the things that were out there at that particular time with St Kilda moving there. But my first game, or I played the pre-season games with them. I was on the first, and we had travelled. We were up in Darwin. Then we travelled over to Hobart or Tasmania. We played a game over there, and I was selected that week for the very first game against Footscray. And like, I was a fair push to get into the first after 1 year, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And
like me, the boy Kenny Sheldon was the manager, and he was new into it, and he had taken over. But it was, that's what I'm saying, it was testing your character. And we started doing these sprints around the wee middle part of the ground, the wee square. It's a big square there that they use. And you were sprinting one side, jogging, sprinting. And he said before we started, he said, I'm going to put you through the ringer here. This is a week before the game. And he goes, he says, there's no backing out of it. And frig me, I shouldn't say it, but I went to take my first sprint, and I pulled the groin, tore the groin. And for 20 minutes, I, like a fool, instead of putting my hand up and saying, Gary, I've pulled my groin here, I went on and did the full 20 minutes after pulling my groin.
Right.
I set myself back. I wasn't able to train. I wasn't able to run. I wasn't able to cycle. I was able to do nothing apart from a wee bit of swimming and my weights, upper body weights. And I was out for about, I missed the first nine 9-10 rounds because of the groin tear. Then, as I say, I come back in and played a reserve game, got picked for the seniors, was in the seniors, but I played 3 games and my fitness had dropped off because of, you know, the pre-season that I'd missed. I just wasn't up to the pace of it for those, you know, 2 or 3 games. And then I went down to the 2s for 2 games, and then I was back to the seniors again, get myself going, and I broke my collarbone and out for 4 weeks. And then I come back, play the reserve game, and my last game against Essendon, I broke my wrist. So that was my second year with St Kilda.
Jesus. That's very unlucky. But they wanted you to stay out. You left after that, right? Because you had to. You were only given 1 year out of Jordanstown in college. But St Kilda wanted you to stay even after all your bad luck.
That's right. Yep. They were keen for me to stay on, and I was prepared to stay on. And then we had everything set up. Jesus, St Kilda were brilliant. They were paying for me. They were paying for me college fees. No, I had got accepted into Footscray Institute of Technology to finish off my PE degree. Everything was set up. I had got the modules. What I had to finish over here at University of Ulster, they were sent over, and Footscray were going through it, and they were able to give me the same study over here, or the same units over here, and everything was grand. And then the next thing, I got a letter from the university saying, God rest him, he's dead now, Professor Saunders, a lovely, lovely man, but he had to follow the university charter, and at that stage it was, if you start the university, if you start in Jordanstown, you have to finish your degree in Jordanstown. So I wasn't able to, what everyone does now in the world, move from country to country to get your education. I wasn't able to do that. And I had to make a short decision whether I stayed on here to, I had to make the decision to drop out. No, they gave me the option of taking another year out and then coming back, or a drop out. So that was what was left with Colm. And I made the decision after talking to a few people that, I would come home, you know.
Right. And did you go straight back in with Derry then? Because I was reading you were out in Boston the following summer. What year did you get back in playing with Derry, and how many years were you gone for?
Oh, I stayed on with Derry whenever I come back. And Boston, I went out to Boston for that summer, I think.
Right.
That summer. So, yeah, that was it. I'm trying to. I'll tell you something now, Colm. You've done your homework. I'm forgetting a lot of stuff here.
But this was the thing, and like, I mean, even if you were gone for the 2 years then, and then back in with Derry. So you're in. I'm trying to kind of get a feeling of. Because the 93 season, when Derry obviously won the All-Ireland, you were an impact sub, which I'm kind of scratching my head wondering how did, you know, Eamon Coleman come to that conclusion? Were you just back in that year, or had you been in there a couple of years before that?
No, I'd been in a couple of years before that, but the final, the 93 final was a decision that Eamon and the management crew at that time would have made, you know. But I think looking back on it now, Eamon and me, to be honest now, I was very disappointed with the result, but to me it wasn't about me, it was about winning the All-Ireland.
Yeah.
And that's really what was the most important thing, to get ourselves over the line, and that's what he was happy enough to do. It's something that, I'll live with it, but I'm still regretting that decision, but I've got over it now, and look, we won the All-Ireland, and that's the most important thing. I still think Eamon was wrong to do that, but me and him have had a chat about it, and it's grand. That's the way it is.
Right. Okay, because it's a funny one, because yourself and Eamon would have gone back a long way. He was over the Miners. He was over Jordanstown when you were winning Sigerson's. Like, he would have known all about you. Then, like, he did admit, he said, it's the hardest team he ever had to announce. He said, it's the hardest team I ever had to announce because Dermot McNichol wasn't starting.
Well, I think Eamon, in his heart of hearts, knew himself that probably he was making a decision that he thought was in his heart was right, and in his head was right, but in his heart wasn't right.
Right.
And that's how I would look at that. Me and Eamon, we go back a long, long, long time. Eamon was, I can remember Eamon coming in, God rest him, he came into the minors in 83, and we had our first training session up in Maherfelt, up the Greenville Leisure Centre up around there, and we were out in the training pitch, and we had been told of Damon Coleman, and nobody knew anything about him, because we had been brought up through minors there. At that stage, you would have had Matt Throne would have been about, and Sean O'Kane would have been about for the the under 21s and minors, and Adrian McGuckin, and all those guys there. Next thing, Eamon Coleman's name was mentioned, and we just didn't know what to expect, and it was so funny. He walked out for the first time with this red tracksuit bottom on him, and this wee moustache, and he got nicknamed. From the very first time he came to us, he got nicknamed the wee Mexican because of the moustache.
Yeah.
And it was so funny, but Eamon knew he was a serious character, and the most important thing with Eamon, look, he had so much time for the players, and people talk about management this and management that. If a manager and a coach cares about the players, they will respond and react to that, we all reacted to Eamon because of his gentle ways, and hey, he was able to call you out whenever you had to be called out, but he was really a player's player and a player's manager, and it's not often you get that,
No, he definitely was. But even the decision not to start you, in the 80s, this would be completely unheard of. I'm trying to understand it. Were you as good a player in 93 as you were in 87 before you went to Australia and got all the injuries?
Well, I'll tell you now, I remember us going down to play. This was maybe about 2 weeks before, 3 weeks before the All-Ireland final. And we had a scratch match down in the pitch down in Autos. We went to the camp and down to Ballycastle. That's where it was. And I remember Mark and Henry Downey, and I can tell you now, Henry was very, very dizzy by the end of that match. Very, very dizzy. And I could not understand why he wasn't picked now at that stage. But listen, he had his reasons. It all worked out for Derry and themselves. And that's the most important thing, I tell you something now, I do regret, is that I didn't challenge him. I did not challenge Eamon at that particular time. I stood back and said, my philosophy was, hold on a second, I'll go out into the training pitch and I'll show Eamon, I'll show who, what I can do, which I did. There were other players have ways of doing it. There's players can ring him and players can get inside Eamon's head that way there. Yeah. I wasn't that type of player. I wasn't anyone that would be, bringing the manager and putting the case. No, definitely not. That's not the way I operated. To me, you do it out in the pitch. And maybe if I had sat down with Eamon before the semi-final or final and had words with him and said, look, I have a case here, I have a case there. And that's what I encourage now. I encourage, in my coaching, I would encourage any player, if they're not happy, because of what I have, because of what I experienced with that decision, I encourage all my players, if you have a problem, if you feel that this isn't right, you come to me because I will listen. And that's something that's something that's very, very important to young players, especially young players. I have no, to be honest, Colin, I should have known because I was 26 or 27 years of age. But again, I just put it down to out on the pitch, do it out on the pitch, and Eamon will pick that up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you'd be forgiven if you had an ego at 26 after everything you'd done in the game up until that point, but you obviously didn't because you were just of the attitude, I'll go out and prove him wrong on the training pitch. You accepted it, which is, a testament to you.
Yeah, look, can I tell you something now, Colm? I had 7 or 8 hard years of accepting that,
Yeah.
But I got over it, At the end of the day, I firmly believe I should have started at that final. Not only me, there's a lot of people in the county would say that as well. There's no doubt in that. But hey, listen, it's nothing to do with Eamon. Eamon's hands sometimes can be tied with selectors and things they got there, you know. I wouldn't have been the most popular with some of the selectors, and because, not right, nothing that I have done, but I'll just leave it at that.
Right. Well, like club rivalries or something?
Yeah?
Club rivalries, maybe, or something like that.
Well, it's not maybe the time to be getting into that, you know.
Okay.
There would have been. Listen, I have forgiven them, and actually forgive the people for it as well. Being honest,
right?
I had a, because if you hold back and you get, you know, you get angry, and you know that doesn't help at all. So
yeah, come here. Just on that, Dermot, is that like number one? You're very lucky in that you got a half. You were brought on at halftime, because back in those days, if you're a sub, you're lucky if you could get bloody 5 minutes. So that's at least one a positive out of it. You played half the game. You kicked an unbelievable point. And I meant to ask you about this, is that Colm O'Rourke, I watched this game. We did a show, a nostalgia show on it a few months ago. And I remember Colm O'Rourke saying, that's a very good score by Dermot McNichol. He's not known for kicking points. And I thought that was a strange one.
I would have shared, you know, whenever we were over in Australia with Colm, but that would be Colm just jesting, you know.
Right.
I would have known Colm through the colleges as well. Colm was taking St. Pat's Keeknavin, and we would have been Maharaj, so we would have had a bit of banter there, you know. So that's where I see that coming from.
Right. Okay. But that I suppose that was the thing. Like, where were you most comfortable playing? It looks to me like it was centre half forward. You have an all-star at corner forward. That was the All-Star you won when you were in school. It looked like you played wing back for the compromise rules. Like, where you're really a real dynamic kind of all action player.
I, you know what, I loved midfield.
Right.
You know, and probably I needed to be a wee bit taller for midfield, but you know, I had a good leap. Midfield was where I really loved playing the game, you know, and I loved centre half forward. Centre half forward, you know, you're really looking. It's changed, or you know, you're looking at the modern day centre half forwards now. Back in my time, a centre half forward basically was the playmaker. You know, he was the boy that was doing the passing in, and or else you have that centre half forward like Larry Tompkins and myself, you know, who and Bart McHugh, who would have been driving through the centre and whatever, you know. But centre half forward I loved as well, but midfield I would say. Definitely, midfield was my position that I liked playing for club and for my county. And funny, before I went to Australia, it was Chris Brown actually was taking the seniors before I left, and I was actually named in the Derry team at wing half back in a National League game. So that was a strange one.
Right. Right, okay. So listen, you'll probably play anywhere from five up the rest of the field. Before I let you go here, Dermot, like, I mean, your nickname is Spoofer. A little birdie told me it's because you're a little bit economical with the truth with women back in your teenage years. Is there any truth in that one?
Oh my God, Colm, that's something to bring up. You know how I got that there? It's the boy Gabriel O'Kane, Billy O'Kane from Dungiven. And we were at Maharaj School together. And Billy one day we messed about, and he came into the school the next day, and I called him a spiffer. I got there, and the next day he came in and he called me a spiffer, and that's how that name stuck. Honest to God, Colm, that is how it stuck. I called him a spiffer, and he called me a spiffer. So no,
it's just as simple as that. Then, so I've got the complete wrong end of the stick here altogether. And be right before.
You got the wrong end, but you know what, Colm? I'm not going to deny it. You know, having the career I had now, I was lucky enough to meet some beautiful woman, and I'm very lucky that I finished off with a really, really a gem of a wife and my wife Ida. You know,
the best one of all.
I have four absolutely beautiful children. Well, they're not children anymore. They're growing up. Like, I have a daughter, Dervla, and she's mad into the football. Dermot, he's done his cruciate now twice, the same knee, his last 2 years. And seriously, Colm, the work that he is putting in is unbelievable. He's never out of the gym. He's never doing the work for that knee. And I hope he does get a break because he's a really good footballer. The two, my two twin boys, Fergal and Callum, the work that they're putting in, and they're on, you know, it's amazing for players, you know, fathers of, or sons of fathers who have, you know, have been, had a good career. The pressure is on them, you know, but I'm so proud of them, the work that they're putting in, because it's, I'll tell you something now, some of the work that they're putting in, I wouldn't have done.
Yeah, no, the workload is big now. And like, you're talking about knee injuries, you're in a bad way yourself, Dermot. Like, you need two knee replacements and a hip replacement. And I suppose when you look back, and we were talking at the start of the interview about all the teams you were on at underage, you know, the rugby, the cycling, all the circuits, all that. Like, I mean, when you look back on it now, like, would you regret that with the pain you're in now, for example? Or what way are you looking at it?
I enjoyed every moment of it, Colm, whenever I was playing and whenever I was training. Like, I enjoyed training as well. I can never understand players saying, oh, I don't like training. I enjoyed the training. I enjoyed the playing. But I'm sitting here now on a sofa with two knees that have to be replaced, especially the left one. The left one is completely banjaxed. The right one is bone on bone as well. And it's the right hip to get replaced as well. So it's taken its toll, but listen, that's the way it is. I have a brilliant career in football, and I've made so many friends. And, you know, it's also led me into coaching. And, you know, I love the coaching end of it as well. And, you know, enjoy giving back what other people give to me, because the people that I was fortunate enough to work with, you know, starting off with Danny McIlvar, you know, through the school, Adrian McGuckin and Paul Hughes, Oliver Hughes, sorry, and then got on to the, you know, Eamon Coleman's and all those guys there, right through to the very top, like with Kevin Heffern and Peter McDermott and oh my God, the managers, Mick O'Dwyer, you know, oh. Kevin Heffern, as I said, those guys, to be luckily involved with those managers and to learn from them, you know, I'm so, so privileged and I'm so happy.
Yeah.
And I want to just, you know, I'm at the stage now where I'm just enjoying watching games, you know, and I'm sure you're the same, Colin.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, it's my job to watch them now. So, like, I mean, that's definitely what I'm doing most of the time. It was good to hear that you're enjoying watching them, Dermot, because there's a lot of negativity, I suppose, about the modern game. And a lot of people of your era kind of, you know, comparing eras and saying it's not as good now.
That's the biggest load of nonsense, Colm, that I have heard. What you're witnessing now is transition, the way football's transition, there was a transition period there, football's moving on, and the only thing I would say, Colm, right, you're looking at the game now from what how we played it, and you'll agree with me here. It was, decisions were made by the players, and, you know, there was great spontaneity in the game, right? Now you have a game which is structured. Look, it's, no matter what you say, it's following the simple process of where the professional game is going. American football, go to rugby, go to soccer, go to all those games. You have a process there, and you have your team plan, and your players are now expected to follow the team plan and to follow the system and to follow the positions. And that's the way it is, right? It's taken away the individual. That's the good thing. It's taken away the bad thing. It's taken away the individual player, that he's not allowed, maybe a good player, to express himself the way he could. But at the same time, it's now a thinking process. The game is a thinking process for coaches, and they have to work out systems, how to beat a certain system. That's Mickey Hart's and them boys, Joe Kiernan's, whatever, they have produced the model. Now managers have to try and beat that model. That's how I see it. And it's very much like business. You have the product and you have to follow it. So that's how I see it. But no, I think the skill level has gone through the roof. I think players now, the way they're able to use their left foot, their right foot, take a look at some of the games that we played in. God, we were never using our left foot the way players are using their left foot now, or their non-preferred foot, I should say. No, I think the game has come on brilliantly.
Yeah.
And no. That's how I would see it at the minute, Colm.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think the skill level has gone completely through the roof, especially with some of the forwards. Come here, Dermot. I've taken enough of your time there. I'll let you go. Thanks very much for chatting to us about your career. Like, it's incredible stuff what you were doing back in the 80s. And fair play to you. Thanks for taking the call.
No bother, Colm.
Yeah, great stuff from Dermot there. I think we can put that to bed, Conor. Greatest minor who's ever played.
Well, anyone who plays in an All-Ireland minor final at the age of 14, is that correct?
Yeah, incredible stuff.
I think, there's no dispute from me on my end anyway, Willie.
Yeah, so he was the David Clifford of the early 80s when there was no social media and no clips of his scores. What he did during the 80s was absolutely phenomenal. We'll move on, Conor, because Desi Farrell has been talking this week, and comes as no surprise to me. He was on a podcast with Kieran Cannon or Karen, and he said, "I definitely think he's talking about the provincial championships." And he says, "I definitely think the competition structure is a big one, and this might not go down well, particularly in Ulster, but I'm no longer a fan of the provincial system. I would be open to change. The one thing we shouldn't be afraid of in the GAA is experiment. You can also always revert back if something wasn't successful." Talking a bit of sense, something you don't hear too many managers really coming out, and this is Dublin after winning. Did they win 10 in a row and 14 of the last 15? Leinster's, you know, it does Dublin no good just strolling through Leinster to prefer more competitive games. You just don't hear that many managers, especially the high profile ones, say get rid of it.
Well, that's why it came as a surprise to me, Willie, to be honest, because everything I've heard of Desi to date, he comes from the Jim Gavin school of dealing with the media. Like, you know, he'll talk away, but he won't really say anything, or certainly not controversial. So, like, especially in a time at the moment where we're kind of short on GAA news, with when there's no games going on, he probably knew that this was going to generate headlines, which it has, obviously. So I was a little bit surprised that somebody like Desi came out with that. And like, I welcome it. I fully agree with Desi. Do you know what I mean? But I think that he's probably more comfortable in saying it because he knows the change is coming down the tracks. I mean, you know, we know that the existing system, you know, got very little support compared to the other options on the table from the Fixtures Review Committee. So he's probably more comfortable in, you know, suggesting that the provincial system should be done away with. And I should say, Willie, that he didn't necessarily say they have to be scrapped. You know, Desi did was fairly vague on what, you know, we should actually do. He just said he doesn't like the provincial system, you know, dictating the championship at the moment, which it still does, you know what I mean? So he could be a big fan of the Woolley model, Willie, and have them played before the championship and then, you know, let the league system take over come the summertime. But I welcome, you know, the support for stuff like this, you know, can only be helped by high profile people coming out, you know, in support of. And they don't get more high profile at the moment than the Dublin manager.
Well, I suppose that's the thing. But the wheels are in motion for this anyways. That's why, because I wasn't surprised of Desi's opinion, because I sat on a committee that the GPA set up in 2010. I remember where the old GPA offices used to be down there in Drumcondra, and there was Kieran Whelan, Dick Clerken was on it, myself, a few others, and we're throwing around ideas to change the provincial system. So this has kind of been in the work. And Desi spoke at that meeting. He chaired it. And like, he was very kind of on the side of, let's try and do something that's fairer, you know, where every county has the same games, every county starts on the same date, all these kind of things. So I wasn't surprised. I was just surprised that he maybe said it publicly. But then again, it is probably a little bit late because the wheels are in motion. And in fairness to John Horan, he wasn't very slow in trying to fix that. So hopefully next year we'll have a new championship structure. I see some people giving out about the GAA insurance thing. John Mulhall was in the Examiner. I saw other people on Twitter. Now everybody gives out about everything on Twitter, but it's like the GAA have stopped covering players for loss of earnings if they're out injured. So the fund has been on the go since 1929. And before this year, if a player couldn't go working because of a GAA injury, they could get 300 euros per week for a maximum of 26 weeks. So, you know, it was a very, very good cover for anybody who got injured playing GAA. But obviously, the GAA's finances have taken an awful hit. They've had no gate receipts, you know, to speak of in 2019, and it looks like it could be something similar this year. So they've taken out the cover for loss of earnings. Now, it has to be stressed that, like, I think it was in 2019, 30% of annual claims made to the fund were to cover loss of earnings, and the other 70% was due to treatment of injuries, you know, surgeries and things like that. And it has to be stressed that that 70% stays. You're still covered for medical surgeries. They're just not being covered at 30% for the loss of earnings. And I don't see what the big problem with this is. Like, money doesn't grow on trees here, Connor. It's a bit like we're going to come out of these lockdowns and everyone's going to be all shocked next year when all, or the year after when austerity returns. Do you know what I mean? Money, where do people think this money's going to come out of? The GAA can't afford this right now. And I don't see a huge big deal in it.
Yeah, yeah, I suppose, yeah. Especially when, as you said, especially when, you know, it still will cover kind of, you know, the cost of major surgeries and stuff like that. And especially when you consider that, you know, schemes like this aren't really in other sports, and the GAA was kind of ahead of the game in terms of offering this sort of service to the players. But
yeah,
I do see it's got a fair bit of opposition. Well, I know Waterford came out with a statement. Cork County Board have been fairly strong in it as well. And the one thing, while I get what you're saying about the fuss, the one thing I will say is where I do understand where people would have concerns is for people who are maybe self-employed and who, you know, don't have anything to fall back on. If they were to get a serious, if they've just gone back playing, you know, playing football or hurling, they get a serious injury and then they've kind of nothing to fall back on, then, you know, I had a bit of sympathy as far as that was concerned, because you're talking about people who are probably, their employment has probably been hit a lot in the last year, as it was anyway, and then they're thinking about going back playing GAA and then potentially getting an injury that might put them out of action, that will affect their earnings as well. So I did have sympathy in that regard as well. But I have to say I've never had to access the player fund myself fully, so
no,
I wasn't aware. So I have to, you know, commend the GAA for running such a scheme like this, and the fact I was not aware at all that it's been in existence since 1929, which is really impressive as well.
Yeah, so very impressive. So, for example, in 2019, counties paid $6.2 million to cover the cost of claims, but the total outgoing for the year was just over $8.1 million. So the GAA made up the $2.5 million difference from gate receipt money. They moved $2.1 million across in 2018. So, like, I mean, this is where the GAA were making it up from gate receipts. They don't really have any gate receipts anymore. And this isn't this being scrapped forever. This is just being scrapped for maybe a year or two until the GAA gets back on its feet and we can have crowds at games. I don't know. Like, I mean, it's funny. The CPA have ran off into the sunset, so they haven't said anything on the matter. And this affects every player in the country. The GPA haven't really said anything on it. I've just kind of more, you say Waterford and Cork have been critical of, but where is the money coming from though, Connor? Like, I mean, at the end of the day, that's the reality. People can't have everything that they want.
And to be honest, Willie, like I haven't dug too deeply into what Cork and Waterford have been saying, but like it's been hypothetical in terms of the solutions that I've seen, in terms of like, well, we need to get the money from somewhere, but not necessarily saying where it's coming from. And then you said as well that counties paid in $6.2 million, was it, in 2019, and then they made up the deficit, they made up the shortfall with gate receipts. But I'd imagine that the amount that counties themselves can pay towards the cost of those claims have been affected as well by everything that's gone on the last year. So
yeah,
it makes it even more complicated. The one I did see one in Cork, a club delegate, this was raised at county board level, I think a club delegate raised the prospect of the GAA partnering with an insurance company to kind of to cover it in some way, or to come up with some scheme that might involve the players paying a little more, but that they, in the event of something like this, in the event of loss of earnings, they'd be covered. And I was thinking then that, like, whether it's Allianz or Liberty Insurance, the GAA does have a lot of history of kind of, you know, being involved with these organizations. So maybe something can be done there to come up with a shortfall. But you can't just say, well, we need the money, and then not necessarily say where it's coming from, because you have to remember we're coming off the backdrop of what the GAA had, a 30 million shortfall or something to that effect in their own finances. So yeah, as you said, money doesn't grow on trees.
Yeah, and as we know, the insurance industry is notoriously generous as well, you know, so they might be able to...
yeah.
Donegal, I was reading this in the Irish News and I was bloody head scratcher really, and saying Donegal are considering moving their 2020 final. So this hasn't been played. It's the same in Laois. The four clubs in Laois, Portlaoise finally out of the championship before the semi-final, first time since 2001 or two. and the four clubs are just sitting on their arses and they can't finish off the championship. But Donegal are considering moving the 2020 final after the 2021 final. Now, who in their right minds would think that's a good idea? Like, I mean, it's the greatest load of nonsense. So the Irish News was saying that the Donegal's Board's Competition Control Committee, the CCC, are looking at putting Kilcar and Niamh Connell back until after the championship was played. Donegal CCC held an online meeting with clubs earlier this week and laid out two potential options where the outstanding final goes first in August and potentially pushes back the start of the 2021 competition, or the 2020 final waits until afterwards. Now, if you play the last year's final first, which would make perfect sense, how far are you going to be putting back this year's one? Maybe 2 weeks at the most?
Yeah. Yeah.
So what on earth would make you think, well, the other option there now is we can just start one now rather than start it 2 weeks late. We'll just start the 2020 final after the 2021 final. So you have the 2021 finalist celebrating, and then you have the 2020 final going on after it. It's just the most bizarre even thought I can think of.
Yeah, and I was thinking, could you imagine if Kilcar if one of them got to the final this year, for example, and one of them was knocked out early?
Yeah.
So you have Kilcar, for example, getting all the way to the final, potentially winning this year's championship, then being in great nick just to play a Niamh Connell team who got knocked out of the championship early and obviously haven't been training as a result. And it's a pity it's unfortunate that no matter when it's played, it's probably going to lack the prestige that it normally would if it had been played in a normal year.
Yeah.
But since the sensible option, and to be honest, from what I've seen since that pushing it back to after this year's championship seems to have been rubbished a bit since from what I've seen. But that's how much of an impact is it going to make on this year's competition? Whatever impact it makes in this year's competition, it makes far more sense than leaving it until after this year's competition, where I don't think I can't envisage anyone who'd be happy with that sort of situation. But yeah.
It just makes, like, I mean, the GAA have been very conservative with the whole COVID thing. Like their decision to scrap all the clubs, when was that? Last October. That was very premature. All it was, maybe two more weekends of club. I know they got a lot of bad press with the celebrations after county finals, but it's really, really unfortunate for the clubs that are still in the championship that, you know, they're not even getting played early this year because of the situation we're in. Then the inter-county will start. They won't have their club players. And it will be August now before those finals are played. And in Leash's case, before last year's semi-finals are played.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, I saw the Niamh Connell manager was actually suggesting that it might be played in May, which seems way too soon. And he was saying that basically that everybody is rubbishing that situation.
Yeah, Donegal would be playing in May, though, no?
Oh, they would, yeah. But just to nearly get this game out of the way, just to have kind of last year's championship wrapped up.
What I'm saying is that the Donegal inter-county team will have loads of Kilcar and Niamh Connell players.
Yeah, I know. This is a suggestion that's probably a little bit kind of not maybe thought through, or I don't know, because it doesn't seem feasible at all if inter-county is back. But it was suggested play it in May to wrap it up, which again seems not feasible to me because Donegal will be back. But actually, it nearly seemed like a better suggestion to pushing it till after this year's championship is over. But you're right, it is. I suppose, Willie, we're what, 6 months on now? So we have to, you know, it is a pity that those championships don't get played. But like, I do remember at the time the level of uproar that greeted kind of some county finals where fans kind of didn't pay attention to restrictions afterwards. So it seems really unfortunate now, but it's probably more understandable the stance that GAA took at the time, given the kind of the mood that greeted kind of some of those games.
Yeah. I think at the time, I don't think I was overly critical of it at the time. It's just like, I mean, maybe two more weeks would have wrapped it all up. I do feel a lot of sympathy for the clubs that put in such an effort last year and now, you know, are just sitting around. So like, where would you even be as a club player? Like, I mean, you've gone through lockdown over Christmas. You would be out of shape. Motivation would be really low. You're heading into a pre-season with a county final, your first game in August. It's definitely a weird one psychologically for players.
I was just thinking that there as well, even though that makes the most sense. I do have sympathy for Kilcar and Niamh Connell as well, because you have to completely taper your training around for one game, and then you nearly have to change it around again to build up for, even though you're playing the championship immediately afterwards, sometimes you kind of build through a championship and try and get stronger and peak for the latter stages. So it's a complete head melt for them with the schedule and stuff. But again, of all the options on the table, it probably makes the most sense.
Yeah, exactly. So Paul Mescal has increased the sales of O'Neill shorts in 2020 by 20%. So Paul Mescal, obviously ex-Kildare minor and acting superstar. Now, if anyone hasn't heard my interview with him, just go search for Paul Mescal on the GAA. Really, really sound fella. Brilliant, brilliant actor. But I was just looking at this. He said the report on this, the Normal People star and former Kildare minor football captain made the €20 O'Neill shorts one of last year's most sought after fashion items. So he goes around, he wore them on a GQ cover shoot. Now, okay. I despise those O'Neill shorts and I cannot believe, I can believe it because I nearly fell, had a heart attack in the sports shop when I went back playing Masters. I think I told my mother to throw out all my old leash gear, whatever. I won't ever be using that again, and port leash gear and the socks and everything. And then when I come back looking to play Masters, I had no gear and I went into the sports shop to buy a pair of shorts and socks. And I nearly had a heart attack. That, like, I mean, the shorts and socks came to about €25, and I was looking, these shorts are €20. Do you know, for just a normal O'Neill's one, no crest or anything on them, the two stripes, and O'Neill's written on them, and said, who in their right mind would pay 20? Now, well, I just did pay €20 for them. And I was like, what on earth? And then I started thinking, I never bought gear in my life, really, for as long as I can remember. I never bought football boots. I'm very, very lucky that I can't remember ever buying a pair of football boots. You know, you just kind of got them for free with leash and you get all the gear for free. €20 for a pair of O'Neill shorts, Connor.
You should have told your mother to put all those leash shorts up on eBay. Can you imagine the money they'd get from them now, Willie? You know, after the thing. Yeah,
greatest minor ever.
Get them signed by Beano as well. Just get the face up a little bit. But do you know the funny thing about that GQ cover shoot? So he was wearing do you know in the magazines like that, they have there'd be a caption underneath. Do you know, it'll be Paul Mescal is wearing. You know, so it'd be Paul Mescal is wearing, so it was on shorts by O'Neill's €20. He was wearing a pullover in the same picture. It was by some brand called Hermes. I've never heard of them before, but it cost €10,000. So whatever Paul Mescal was wearing, I know his runners probably would have cost €50 or something like that. So he was wearing an outfit that cost up on €11,000 and the shorts only cost €20. So but you're right, I'm with you on I've never had to buy a pair of O'Neill shorts, Willy, and I would never wear them in public as well. All the shorts that I've ever had were white shorts because my club wears white shorts and my legs are pasty enough as they are without having to kind of amplify that even more with white shorts. So obviously, like, Paul Mescal could pull them off, and a lot of people thought they could pull them off as well if the sales increased by 20%. But fair play, O'Neill's really jumped on that bandwagon last year. And sure, why wouldn't they after how successful Normal People was, especially after your interview with Paul as well?
Yeah, I think that interview really shot him to stardom, really, that interview on the GAA for Paul Mescal. So, yeah, O'Neill's €20. If you saw Paul Mescal wearing a pair of O'Neill shorts and rushed out to buy a pair of O'Neill shorts, well, then I don't know what hope there is for the world. That's basically, we'll leave it on that one. Right, we'll be back next Thursday, as usual, with a show, and we'll talk to you all then. Good luck.
And when I started running, I suppose I didn't stop. And when I got the chance to go, I said I should go. And so I opened up.
We're only the small little fish out there, so we are. And we're trying hard to make it through. But it's hard to get the breaks when you're the smaller fish.
Because I love this county so much, you know. And it's just, I'm delighted that the lads did it for the people of Waterford today. Because, like, I'm heartbroken. I let it go, because I won't see you later.